I am very pleased to see that my old friend Niels is here today to talk about his new book, which is a book which I have had the chance to read and a book which I recommend everyone with an interest in just trying to understand turbulence in not just European Western politics over the past decade or so, and trying just to get a better handle on understanding what's been going on. Related to that is, of course, for at least those of us who call ourselves liberals and who have watched the populist development with concern, I think it's also a book which is necessary for us in order to prompt us to reflect on perhaps things that we've done wrong, perspectives that were perhaps ignorant, even arrogant, approaches to our understanding of society which didn't accommodate all the things we need to accommodate in order to have a broader ideas climate which is open, inclusive, inviting to people of different types of beliefs and different types of preferences in life. We're now on the verge of a European Parliament election. You've all seen the forecasts about how populist parties are probably going to make the best election ever they've done in the European Parliament election. We say that every time when there is an election to European Parliament, but it's just a reflection of reality that these parties have become increasingly strong nationally. And of course that they sometimes also find it easier to get a better foothold in European elections because turnouts in elections tend to be lower. And if you bring a message which may be contradictory to more establishmentarian type of views, it's maybe easy just to get a good turnout and a good showing in an election, allowing you, of course, to use Brussels and the political environment here as a good platform also for whatever you want to do nationally. This is what we're going to discuss today. I'm going to give the floor to Niels to kick us off with a presentation of his book. I'm going to ask him a couple of questions and then we discuss together. Niels, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much, Sean. Thank you for coming. This book was published 2 months ago. It's open access. You can download it for free on Palgrave Macmillan or Springer. So it's please do, and please share it with friends as well. I've been talking about this book in a number of places. I'm going to the U.S. next week to give 4 different presentations. And it's been downloaded by now more than 20,000 times, actually. I hope there's some potential. I'll pass this around. You can take a look at it. But it's available as well. So, populism is a worldwide pandemic, right? Say it's not only within Europe. It's not only comes from the right. It also comes from the left. And this book is about understanding what has happened, why it has happened, how can we explain this, what defines populism, and what can we do about it. And it's written from the perspective of classical liberalism. Populism is not an ideology in the traditional sense of conservatives, socialism, or anything like that. And it's compatible, I would say, with all ideologies except classical. And as you know, these kinds of ideas that I will explain here have taken over some of the established traditional parties as well. And kind of methods that populists use are used by other parties. So I'll try to explain this the best I can. So just a couple of decades ago, our ideas were taken over the world, basically. Markets were deregulated, tariffs were cut down, democracy was winning, across the globe, actually. And the number of democracies increased. The world became more and more free. And this classical quote here by Fukuyama, you know, the end of history. We thought that the open society, liberal democracy was going to stay here. But as you know, this is not really the case anymore. The world has developed into a very polarized type of situation, not only in Europe, in the US, we can see it on the news every day, but in India, Latin America, Turkey, many, many other places. In fact, the level of democracy today is down to the level of 1986, before the fall of the Berlin Wall. And the number of autocracies are increasing. Even within democracies, they are autocratizing. They're becoming more autocratic, limiting the rule of law, limiting individual liberties, rights of minorities, freedom of the press, and so on. And there's numerous studies of this. This is just came out last week. This is the Economist Index of Democracy around the world. And it goes on from 2006. And as we know, you know, during the pandemic and everything, there was a sharp decrease here in the level of democracy worldwide. This is, but then it was recovering, but now it's falling again. So it's down to the lowest level ever. And there are many, many other, you know, Freedom of the World indexes. VDEM Institute in Gothenburg in Sweden studying this with very extensive data. The pattern is very, very similar. Freedom House are similar figures. This is the Fraser Index of Economic Freedom. And the drop here came, you know, during the COVID-19. But it still keeps, it's still down on very low levels. So in fact, the level of economic freedom was still increasing for a number of years, but now that has fallen as well. And that's not perhaps so surprising. If you limit the rule of law, if you start to raise, you know, protective tariffs, if you try to limit liberty and so on, in the end, markets will be hurt as well. And we can come back to this in the discussion. So what I tried to do in this book is to explain what populism is. There's some extensive literature about this, very seldom from my perspective. And some people say you can't define populism. It's like a chameleon, you know, it adapts to various circumstances, to different ideologies, as I mentioned. But it's, in my perspective, it has three key characteristics. And the first one is unserious, ill-founded policies. If you want simplistic answers to very complex problems, right? Like increasing, you know, benefits, public expenditures at the same time as cutting down taxes. Or raising tariffs, protective measures to save jobs or failing industries. And there's been some very good studies published recently in good journals where people have evaluated the effects of populist regimes. And the first one is Latin America. You know, populism more or less started in Latin America with Juan Perón in Argentina in the 1940s. He was inspired by his experience as a journalist in Italy, you know. You can imagine where those ideas came from, adopted it to a democratic context, but using similar kinds of strategies as the fascists. And this is Edwards, a long period here from the end of the Second World War up until today, has evaluated the results of populist regimes in Latin America, mostly left-wing in Latin America, but some right-wing as well. And it turns out, as you see here, that in the end, the cost is very, very high. Also for the people who supported these machines from the first place, they end up worse off because they destroy the economy, right? In another study recently published in the American Economic Review, 51 different populist episodes in history during the last century, up until today, showed that populists, after 15 years, GDP was 10% lower than before the situation. So unserious, ill-founded promises is a key thing. They promise a lot, but they don't deliver, right? The second, I would say, more important definition is how they do this. This comes from sociology, from political science, mostly these kinds of definition. So populism is regarded as a rhetorical style and discourse frame. You frame questions, you frame crises, you frame economic problems. In a way saying, that it was the swamp, the elites, the establishment that caused all these problems, while we, the true people, were disregarded, disrespected, and so on. So they use this we against them logic, kind of tribal logic, saying, we are good, they are evil, to create this sentiment, trigger kind of tribalness. They don't use rational argument, they use narrative, emotional arguments, they construct reality in a sense. It's not a real world, it's a constructed world where you create enemies. It could be elites of different kinds, and with some examples here later, but it could also be threatening others, like Muslims, Jews, groups that threaten the identity of the true people. And they, attack these institutions, they attack the free press, they demonize opponents and so on, in a deliberate way. It's a deliberately created polarization. I would say this is a key feature of populist movements, how they do it. And you can think of examples, I don't have to mention them really. We have a couple of them here. This is Duterte from the Philippines. He, like many others, populist leaders, also what in the literature is called flaunting the loo, kind of locker room logic, bad boys language, So he repeatedly said that both the Pope and the American presidents were sons of whores. He bragged about extramarital affairs, he bragged about killing things in the streets himself. And that's something that populists sometimes do. So I won't go through this in detail, but there are both right-wing and left-wing versions of this. How to frame things in this way, this rhetorical way about constructing, creating narratives about enemies, the elites, the pure people, the good people. From the left, it's basically the standard Marxist way of arguing, right? People are good, the capitalists are bad. And there, typical stories, neoliberalism, of course. Tax cuts, deregulations, privatization. That has what's created all evil in society. They attacked, institutions like the World Bank, IMF, and so on, as the evil, and capitalist entrepreneurs. And so from the right, it's more a nationalistic, native argument, kind of argument, patriotism. Enemies are kind of similar sometimes, experts, academics, media, established parties, cosmopolitan elites. The story is, of course, naturalist, cultural identity, anti-immigrant, non-migration, traditional law and order. Sometimes it's not that easy to distinguish between these kinds of sides. If you take many of the so-called right-wing populists in Europe, they are favoring the welfare state. They have left-wing policies when it comes to welfare, but they are very conservative when it comes to, values and abortion and marriages and the church and all this. So many populists are not either right or left, they are in the center. But they explicitly use this kind of rhetoric, etc. When populism really becomes dangerous, this is the third characteristic, defining characteristic. So it's an autocratic tendency built into this way of arguing this way of thinking. If the true people is good, the other people don't really count, right? If you don't get enough votes in the election, well, it's not their problem, you know? We don't have to count those people who are not part of our group. Well, you can think of present American situations, for example. Why respect the rights of minorities? Why care about checks and balances? So it's a kind of Rousseauian, you know, idea about the common will, the right of the good people to decide what's democratic. So they're not against electoral democracy. Populists usually have elections, but they're not free elections. The press is not free. They control their elections in various ways. So this is when populism really becomes dangerous. And it's part of the idea structure of populism. So, and it's deeply illiberal, of course. And it arises within democracies themselves. I have a long chapter about how to explain this. And I go through explanations that others provide, like globalization, inequality, migration, policy failures, the role of social media, I do think is very important here. But my main point in this, saying that, you know, institutions, they may fail, economic conditions may change, globalization, China, whatever, you know. But the key thing is that this populist framing, this rhetoric, make people interpret changes like this in a way that people understand it sharpens their interests and their identity. And that promotes this autocraticization. Globalization, structural change, changes in social divides, and so that's nothing new. It's happened through history all the time. That's what, you know, growth and progress is all about, in a sense. You know, jobs will disappear, but others will be created. But the populists use this, frame this in such a way that they diminish democracy. These ideas, the way of doing this, can be traced back to thinkers like Carl Schmitt, the German, you know, Nazi, very famous law professor who defined politics. The essence of politics, according to Carl Schmitt, is to identify an enemy that threatens the interest of your own group. That's a key defining characteristic of politics. And that's exactly what these people do. And the same ideas were developed by Martin Heidegger. And today, the main thinkers are on the left, actually. So Chantal Mouffe, Belgian, actually, is a key leftist who argue in favor of populism, explicitly referring to Carl Schmitt. And these ideas are the studies of Chantal Mouffe and her husband, Ernesto Laclau, an Argentinian. They are, you know, hailed by Stephen Bannon and all these people on the right side as well. So it's a kind of symbiosis here between left-wing and right-wing populism. And they deliberately use the same ideas. And what the essence of this is a kind of collectivistic identity politics. So what they say is that they offer a sense of belonging and a meaning to people. People who perhaps feel disregarded, not respected, as Frederick mentioned, you know. It's us against them. And a very, you know, meaningful, purposeful, actually, you know, we fight against these evil enemies of the people. And it's apparently, this is very attractive. So I have, you know, friends, old friends in the US and in Europe as well, the well-educated people who are caught within this logic. It's very surprising, but it's apparently something that can attract even very, very well-educated people. So, that was the first part of the book. The other part is about what should we do about it? And since my own background is classical liberal, I believe in the longer run, if we're going to save democracy, we're going to save the open society, if we're going to save, you know, the kind of lifestyle we have, classical liberalism is the answer to this. We can discuss this more, but I don't think that these other ideologies can offer the right long ones solutions. It's not about, you know, providing more benefits, more redistribution or things like that. It's about improving the liberal institutions. It's about improving the way markets, civil society work. And my own addition to this, I think, has been disregarded, what I call the liberal spirit. Liberalism is not only about markets. It's not only about institutions, not only about property rights, liberal democracy and all this. It's also about, you know, the kind of life we can live in these open societies. Pluralistic promotion of self-authorship. We can create meaning ourselves within families, within communities. It doesn't have to be super individualistic. Liberal institutions provide the framework, the best framework available from my perspective to really live a good, meaningful life. If we make the state too big, this won't be possible. So I can't go into this in detail here. We can discuss it. So I have three or four broad categories of reforms or counter strategies. The first one is to expose these deliberate polarizations that the populists, in fact, do. I think when you think of your own countries, if you think about European levels, you can think of how they always try to blame on others, how they always try to pick these threatening others that threaten the identity of people and so on. It's a deliberate, constructed way with narratives to create this we against them logic and to explain the consequences of these kinds of policies. The second one is, of course, and I have a number of suggestions here, is to defend and develop the liberal institutions. First of all, the rule of law, the most basic things in liberal societies, we have to defend that. So the state need to be strong, limited, and decent. That's what I argue. And I have a number of suggestions concerning social mobility, integration of immigrants, how to improve public discourse and reforming social media and so on. But I won't go into that. The third, and I think perhaps most essential way of fighting back against the populist is to embrace and promote this liberal spirit I mentioned. I don't think rational arguments will, or economic arguments will, do the job here. So we need to be better to explain why a liberal society, really pluralistic, tolerant, open society, is better for people. It provides better circumstances, better opportunities to live good lives, basically. Within families, within communities, where you can develop and flourish as a human being. So I argue in favor of human flourishing here as the key idea. And in the end, of course, this has to be implemented by statecraft. We have to get into politics to do this, and we need to raise resources to promote policy entrepreneurs to support this kind of change. And it can't be done from top down. It has to be done also from the bottom up. So you need leaders and so on, also within civil society, but also within the private business sector to do this too. Otherwise, things will not turn out very well. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Niels. Since I have read the book, I know it's you have left out quite a lot. So again, I certainly urge you, recommend you to go and read the book, because there is much more in there. One thought that occurred to me also when reading your book is sort of when you talk about the liberal spirit, are we talking about more of a liberal psychology? It seems to me if we take someone like Trump, if you look at his demagoguery, one of the things which is extraordinarily effective is sort of the exculpatory nature of what he's saying, which is that whatever happens in the world, and you may feel it's going in a very, very bad direction, but it's not your fault. It's always someone else's fault. It's not your fault. You have no agency in creating whatever you thought was a bad situation for you. If that was, job market has changed or your education isn't really as much demanded these days as it were 30 years ago, or your neighborhood has developed in the wrong way, but it's not your fault. It's always someone else's fault. And that's exculpatory nature is, it's extraordinarily powerful in order to relieve responsibility from individuals. And then, of course, you combine it with that notion that whatever we propose, it's cost-free. We can go and say, it's what's the latest bid from Trump in how much the average tariff level is going to go. I think he's saying now we're going to raise tariffs to 60% generally on all. And it's not going to cost the American economy anything. Well, that's amazing. It's cost-free. But it seems to me sort of you are taking away agency from individuals. And what I read from your book is basically it's the opposite which should constitute the liberal spirit, which is self-authorship or providing more capabilities for individuals to change whatever they need to change in their own life because they have responsibility. Mm. You agree with that?
Yes, I think you're making a very good and important point here. It's my first characteristics here of populist was unserious, unfunded, ill-founded policies. So they promise a lot and they're going to fix it, the strong man is going to fix it. In the end, it doesn't really work that way. And it gives meaning, I think this is very essential, this collectivistic identity. So I devote one chapter in the book to analyze the concept of meaning, basically. To me, this is a kind of revelation for myself, actually. So I have a background as an economist, political scientist. We tend to think that people are rational. Interests matter. But what I come to realize, in a sense, that people are searching meaning. So why do you sit there? Why do you do the work you do? You don't do it for the money, I think, basically. You do it because you think it's interesting, it's meaningful. You think you contribute to something, right? So meaning to me has three dimensions. And the first one is community, to be part of, something, identity and meaning. The other one is having a purposeful thing. Usually purpose that's a bit bigger than yourself. It's not about only reaching yourself. It's about, creating an empire, as Schumpeter said, he discussed entrepreneurship. So big entrepreneurs they don't care about the money. They want to create something, right? And thirdly, it's about virtue, the character of you as a person. And what populists can't deliver is character. And Trump is the best example of this, I would say. So the virtue, the character of a person, that's what gives a meaningful life, right? What kind of virtues do you have? What defines you as an individual? What's your identity? It's a lot about character, right? It's a lot about virtues. And an open, pluralistic, liberal society can offer that. Populists cannot. And I don't think in the end they can offer community either. And I don't think really that they can offer a meaningful purpose either, because it's a failure. So I think this is the key thing to argue against. It's not only about economics, not only about, welfare systems and stuff like that. It's about how can we explain that an open, liberal market system is superior when it comes to lifestyle, meaning, and all this. That's my key argument.
Mm. And that to me seems, if you take an historical view on it, you would say, Well, you want to have, and you go through this with the institution, so you want to have the inspiration from classical liberalism a la John Locke, in terms of a concept of human nature connected to liberal institutions. We have other Anglo-Saxon influences on the open market economy, on the spontaneous order of a free society. But there seems to me there's also another dimension to it, which is more connected to more French liberal thinking. People like Alexis de Tocqueville, Victor Hugo, and many others that sort of at a time, which have similarities to where we are right now, where you have sort of a black-red type of political development, where both the extremes are becoming stronger and stronger. They are both collectivist in their attitudes and in their concepts about society. And then begins an extraordinarily enriching development of ideas, which sort of goes in the direction of liberal psychology about sort of avoiding these extremes and trying to focus on agency or your individual and what you can do with it on your own. My question related to that is, well, if we go through history, we can see cycles of revolt or reflect of rebels that are trying to change the established order of one kind or another. And you can see historically that, at least in the benefit of hindsight, that there was a reason for why these revolts arrived. Now, what's the reason for why all these populist actors have become so attractive and why apparently a lot of voters are prepared to give them the benefit of doubt, or at least give them the opportunity to have their shot on political leadership? What is it in the modern development which explains that these things are happening now?
So several interesting questions here. Let me start with the French philosophers. There's a good book out called Liberalism in Dark Times. His name is Chernitz, and he takes Aron, as an example. But there are many others, you know. And the examples I give here in the book is basically Wilhelm von Humboldt and John Stuart Mill, of course. They also cared about these wider things, about human flourishing, about the importance of liberty to learn from others, to make mistakes, to have experiences. Well, things you can do in a liberal society which really promotes the good for everyone in the long run. So the populists, they want to define the good for you. They have the answer. What's the good life? They want to use the state to enforce the good from above. In a liberal society, it's up to everyone. By experience, from learning from others, you know, pluralism, all this, that's what the liberal institutions offer. And I think Wilhelm von Humboldt, you know, he wrote a very early book, actually, about, well, the importance of liberty from this perspective. And so did John Stuart Mill in several books, but in particular on liberty, of course. Coming back to the causes. I think, you know, there are many different causes. I mentioned some of them, like, you know, inequality, policy failures. There are many policy failures in our society which need to be fixed, of course. I mean, the world is changing, and we have to be there and constantly reform things. I think perhaps liberals thought they had won. You know, many good reforms were implemented, you know, in the late 1980s, 1990s. Growth returned, you know, and everything went very well for some years, and we thought we didn't have to do anything more, like Fukuyama, in a sense, back then, you know. And that's never the case. You have to be there, you have to reform your own reforms, basically, you know, after some years. So we didn't do that. So we opened up, I call it the idea vacuum. So we didn't develop our own ideas. And that opened up the opportunity for these kind of dangerous forces to come in there and say it's the fault of immigration, you know. It's so interesting. If you take a country like Poland or Hungary, they hardly took on any immigrants, you know. Very, very low numbers. But they used it with this kind of rhetoric, you know, to create this way against them logic and well, start dismantling the democratic liberal institutions in their own countries. It's telling, you know, how effective that was. Also, I think, you know, there are many problems in our societies where when things change, people feel verlassen, if you want, you know, and not respected, not... People don't listen to them, basically, you know. And that's something, as if it's our own fault. We should have done a better job. That's basically the argument I have.
So take a couple of specific instances and ask you about them. 2008, 2009 financial crisis. You think that was a trigger, a contributor, the source of a big political avalanche that took a lot of people in populist directions? I mean, and you can see in that case, perhaps there was a good reason for it if you look at some of the consequences, you know, bailing out big banks without, what is it, the logic here, you privatize profits, but you socialize losses, and not using the liberal institutions in order to deal with them.
That you sound like a populist. I think that argument is quite effective, and I'm partly right. You know, it's of course mistakes were made. You know, policy mistakes were made. I mean, you all know about, you know, the Clinton reforms and these housing things in the U.S. Some people blame the deregulations of capital markets, you know, in the 1980s as the cause of all this, you know. That's popular among economists to say that, you know, we shouldn't have deregulated capital markets, the financial markets in the 1980s, which all countries did, basically. But then they forgot that this created enormous wealth, you know, and growth and jobs and technical change and everything, you know. It had enormous benefits, but we didn't really make those reforms, you know, sustainable in the long run. We should have been there and kept reforming them, of course, when we saw mistakes and so on. We didn't do the job there. So when it comes, I mean, populists always use as a crisis. And this crisis was enormous, of course. And well, think of Greece, for example. To give some good examples. You know, we have the example of Poland, you know, where hopefully we can turn things, you know, Tusk problem is France there can make the job to change it. Greece is very interesting. In the euro crisis following the global financial crisis, you have both left and right-wing populist parties more or less taking over the country. But now it seems like, you know, Greece is somehow, you know, back on track and the established parties are there again. Well, it can be discussed.
That's rule of law. I mentioned rule of law.
Well, but it could have gone a lot worse, you know. It's kind of promising development. We have to find good examples as well where you can turn things, you know. And I think Greece is an inspiring example, I think, yeah, for a country that was in really, really deep trouble. You know, that, in a sense, has started to turn around, at least, you know, even though things are not perfect. So I don't think, you know, the global financial crisis itself was the cause. It's the way it was framed, the way it was interpreted from both the left and the right. And I think the left here did most of the job here for the populist, actually. But it was, you know, a policy failure. It was a market failure in many ways. And it's fantastic that we saved it. You know? That's how I look at it. It's enormous that politician actually made some good decisions in a very, very dangerous situation. Those decisions had cost, but in the long run, I think they were wise decisions to own, which is very impressive. It's very hard to make those kinds of decisions. But that's my view. So if you take Italy, where, you know, populism in Europe, you know, has taken over everything, basically, it was corruption. So corruption is the most dangerous crisis that you can offer populists. If the established parties are corrupt, as apparently happened in Portugal, I asked around in the paper as well, no, then open for the populists to move in there. You can increase numbers very, very quickly.
Really? But if I just drill down a little bit further on sort of the combination here between perhaps more systems and how systems perform and whether systems are reformable and the extent to which they may have triggered popular reactions against the system. And we start with financial crisis. I think a lot of people, not just populists, went away for it thinking that, well, there is a way to save systems from breaking down, but they are extraordinarily difficult to reform to become sustainable over the long term. We moved into the euro crisis here, and it was this sort of constant back and forth with Greece, with Italy, with others, where it just becomes extraordinarily difficult to try to understand where is political responsibility in the system. Who is responsible? If I want to make someone accountable for things that happen, who do I vote for? Who do I vote against? And the blurring of that type of accountability may have triggered some legitimate popular responses to problems that populist responses
you may well be right, but maybe that's how the world works, you know. The world is a very complex system, you know. Financial markets are very complex. It's very hard to identify one individual, one institution that is responsible for it worse, because it's a system, you know. As Eleanor Ostrom, it's a polycentric system, a system where different kinds of actors, you know, contribute to the emergence of the system. It's not a constructed system from above. It's something that has emerged in a very complex way, involving, you know, private actors, markets, but also public actors and institutions and regulations and so on. And that's how a pluralistic open system works. You know, it's something we have to live with. So maybe we should be more open to the fact that crises may come, you know. It's hard to balance systems like this. It's perhaps even impossible.
Mm.
But when a crisis comes, I mean, we have to be ready to act and do our best to fix it. And as I said, I think we did a pretty good job there. I'm not that critical.
Mm. So maybe then sort of one explanation to the question, so why now, is because of much greater transparency through the fact that society is very complex. I mean, old mental models that we used in Western politics for a long time, which were based on a pretty hierarchical, transparent, sort of more simplistic type of economy in society, they don't work anymore. And it's just that we don't have the language, we don't have the rhetoric, we don't have the concepts which are easily communicated to people that this is a very complex society. And if you really want to have someone to blame for anything, well, you probably shouldn't live in a democracy in an open society, because it's just going to be impossible to be there.
Well, still, this is nothing new. I mean, open societies, democratic societies, market societies work like this. You know, they are polycentric. They are emerging, you know, and it's not only formal institutions, it's informal institutions. It's based on, you know, rules of just conduct, as Hayek famously said. These informal institutions, how to behave within these formal institutions, are equally important, and they change, you know, in an organic way, just like languages or anything else. You know, it's a spontaneous order, to take Hayek's, you know, concept here. So the problem is that, I mean, we've seen all kinds of crises through history, of course, and apparently this time we shouldn't make the financial crisis the key explanation here, you know, and we shouldn't. So I have an argument. It's one thing I should add here. It's social media, of course, that's new. Social media has definitely contributed to populism. It's very clear, you know, that these algorithms, well, support this kind of we against them logic, you know, with echo chambers, and people get caught into different perspectives without seeing other sources of information and so on. So I lived in the U.S. a number of times in my life, and nowadays, I mean, people, both sides are so, it's so divided. They don't have a public discourse in it. There's no public media anymore. It's gone. While Europe still has it, you know, we have to really take care of our big newspapers and public television and the thing that we have here. In the U.S., it's gone. It's gone. So social media is something that is new, for sure. I think that's more important than a financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So I forgot to learn.
Fuck with you.
I think
you're right. I mean, in terms of getting to the point, why now? Why it's happening? I think social media is
social media is not the answer, but it's part of the big answer here.
Hmm. That of course, which allows for only simplistic messages about complex problems.
Wow. At the same time, as digital social media is a very fantastic thing because people. Well, that was a question about transparency. I mean, people know more than ever. I mean, there are numerous studies saying that people are more well informed. They know more about the world. They understand more than ever before. But they do it in a skewed way.
Hmm.
That's and we have to fix this either by self-regulation or, in fact, by some kind of like as we have for printed media. I mean, we have rules here. Some of them are developed by media themselves, and others are enforced by law. And they do have to do things similar things here when it comes to social, but in a very careful way.
Is there a globalized nature of the political debate you think is important as well? I'm having one anecdote that I'm thinking about, which is I saw an interview with a German academic who was breaking with his social network and coming out as they was going to vote for the right wing extremes, and why? Well, it was always referring to the academic culture in America, and you were thinking, well, but that's not on the ballot here in Germany. You know, whatever happens sort of in the American culture war, it's not going to be on the ballot in Germany. So why are you using an international example for making a vote in your own country, which is probably going to be very misinformed if that's what you want to do? So it's sort of globalization in this sense, sort of creating. Concept images where sort of we think there is something going on just because we read about it in American media, but it isn't really an issue here where we live.
That could definitely be a fact, yeah. And also, of course, you know, people like Trump inspires other leaders with similar tendencies and ambitions. So it's, yeah. No, but it's really a global phenomenon. It's, if you look at India, Modi's way of, you know, promoting Hindu nationalism, you know, attacking Muslims and so on, very, very similar. Also, you know, not really respecting the institutions of a democracy, you know, the freedom of the press and the rights of minorities and so on. It's a very, you know, they inspire each other, and the left and right, and it's kind of symbiosis here. That's why we have to fight back.